I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver. This is thecommentary.ca. The musician and author, Paul Myers, joins me again. He's just published a new book, a look at the legendary music producer and musician in his own right, Todd Rundgren, a wizard, a true star, Todd Rundgren in the studio. We'll talk about how the book came about, who Myers talked to for this, who Rundgren is, and the influence he's had on recording and music. In a 40-year career, Rundgren has produced nearly everyone from Cheap Trick, Hall & Oates, Grand Funk, the New York Dolls, Patti Smith, The Band, and many others. A Wizard of True Stars, published by Jawbone. The Paul Myers blog is at plumyears.wordpress.com. Mr. Myers was last on for his biography of Long John Baldry, It Ain't Easy. He's also written a book on the Bare Naked Ladies. He joins me from Berkeley, California, where he lives. Please welcome back to the Planta Online program, Paul Myers. Good morning, Mr. Myers.
Hey, good to talk to you again.
Thanks for joining us.
Hey, no problem at all.
So I've already bought the book, so you're going to convince me and those listening to buy the book and in my case to read the book. Why does someone like me, who doesn't like this sort of music, I mean, I've listed those people. I mean, I like The Band, I guess. I like Lee Von Helm. But, you know, I'm more of a Sinatra fan, right?
Sure.
What influence has Rundgren had on music in general?
Well, here's the thing about Rundgren. His story is interesting the same way you might be interested in the stories of D.W. Griffith, the filmmaker, or the stories of Les Paul, the 1950s innovator, in that one of the sort of arch angles I took in the book was, whether you liked any of the music he ever made, Todd Rundgren seemed to have popped up like Woody Allen's Zelig. He seems to have popped up in the histories of so many other people. So he was an influential artist to begin with, but he was also an influential recording producer who used the emerging multi-track recording, you know, technology that usually involved tape in those days. So in the days when people, you know, had 24 tracks to play with, and he would fill them all up with his own instruments. But he also, when he worked with other artists, managed to somehow distill what they did, quite often in a way that was either commercial or artistically significant. And the weird swing of his career is that not every record he did was a solid seller. But on the one hand, he did like the seminal New York Dolls first album, which became, you know, it launched 1,000 punk rock bands. And then he also produced Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell, which was one of the most commercial rock albums of the 70s. And probably one of the biggest selling albums of all time. And in the middle there, he did Patti Smith Group, the English group XTC. If you ask certain people of a certain post New Wave era, one of the finest albums of the English New Wave was Skylarking, and produced by Todd Rundgren, and it had a very strong influence from Todd. And so just in those ones I've mentioned, there's enough to write about, but then if you write it from the whole point of view of his entire career, as I did, I found it was a compelling story for me to be checking out rather than just writing, you know, and then I hope it's compelling for readers.
Yeah. Now, if you listen to all these artists, is there, I mean, it's very odd to talk about music to talk about sound, but is there a unique sound with all these artists that he's produced?
Yeah, one of the things that Todd Rundgren is famous for and infamous for is that he is a very feel-oriented, impulsive engineer, and he quite often breaks the machines he works with. So he's not a meticulous knob twiddler like an Alan Parsons or even some of the engineers that worked on Quincy Jones records were very meticulous. But Todd Rundgren would often engineer his own records or usually instruct the engineer to do crazy things. And so a lot of his records sound reckless, and they sound really, the word I use is a non-musician word, is crunchy. A lot of his records sound very bright, very brittle, and very in your face. So the drums sound really thwacky, you know, and the guitars are just right there. And he's definitely an impulsive, almost ADD mixer when he mixes a band. So a lot of the records he has sound very harsh and in your face. Now that doesn't mean they're not appealing to some people, because what it is the feel, the human energy of all these things, the roughshod nature of it is very immediate and feel oriented. So you can actually get the emotional reaction from these records, whereas sometimes something like a Toto record, the group Toto from the same era, very meticulous. Everything's meticulous, and quite often people just go, "That's very nice," but they can chop broccoli to it. You know, it's not involving. So that's one thing about Todd is his records, you either love them or you hate them, but you always know they're there.
And how is he viewed in the music industry?
Well, he's viewed, there are two distinct camps. Well, actually three. If you count the people that don't really even recognize him, that's the third camp. But amongst the people who are aware of him, there's kind of a devotional extreme of people who just, like, you know, literally say the phrase, Todd is God. And, you know, in my book I point out that he's far from God, but, you know, I sort of make the case for why people would say that. And on the other hand, there are people who, his people skills haven't been, he's an interesting guy, like Orson Welles was as a director. If he didn't like something, or if he doesn't like an idea that you've presented, he does not waste any time. He doesn't waste any time being nice about it. And a lot of times, you know, he had the attitude of, you hired me to make this record good. Are you going to shut up and listen to me or not? And on the other hand, people who've worked for him love the results, and then they go, wow, I guess he really did know what I should do, and he was really just trying to make me make a better record. But a lot of times people don't forgive him either. So there are people who have had their noses bent out of joint by working with Todd Rundgren. So there's that camp, you know. There's that camp of people who would say, yeah, he's a great guy, but I know why he's not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is because he has not kissed enough you-know-what.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a feeling like, you know, I'm surprised he's not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame considering just the productions he's done, but, you know, that's maybe that has to do with the people skills because there is a lot of handshaking involved in those things.
Has he won Grammys?
He has won, wow, that's a really, you know, you're the first person to ask that question. I don't have the stats in front of me for Grammys because I have to say I wrote this book from a point of view of not caring about things like sales figures and stats like that. And that's very cool that you asked that, and I'm somewhat embarrassed that I don't have that kind of knowledge. I'm sure I could find it for you by the end of the day.
I could have looked it up, yeah.
To be honest, I don't think it matters whether he's won Grammys. I think he actually got nominated, he got nominated for a Broadway album, believe it or not, for a Tony, and I think he got nominated for the Grammy for that, too. And again, I'm embarrassed that I don't know the other stuff.
So that obviously doesn't motivate him then, I guess, right?
No, and that's the whole point of the book, actually. That's really what I was saying.
Yeah.
The point of the book is not whether or not, you know, I'm going to prove that he has had a million number one records, because he hasn't. He's had a lot of top 20 and a lot of top 10, and I think even certain number one singles, like Hello, It's Me, and I Saw the Light was, I think, a top 20, and We Gotta Get You a Woman was a big hit in the early 70s, but he hasn't been known for having chart hits of his own. A lot of records he's produced have gone big, like you know, Meatloaf sold millions of copies and that sort of thing. So yeah, he's not really, he doesn't gauge his success by those things, and certainly the reason you haven't heard from him for years on end is because what motivates him is completely based on his own whim. He might design computer software next year, and you know, he's done that before, and he doesn't really stick with one thing, and I think he's got ADD for sure.
Yeah. How did you come to write this book?
I'm a musician and a producer, as well as being a writer. I kind of became a writer because of my love of explaining music to people. And over the years, I started to realize that the books that I write are usually about things that I can get excited about. And when I was about 16, God knows how many years ago, I heard some of the earlier Todd Rundgren albums as an artist, like his own artist records. Something Anything was an album he did, and another album called The Hermit of Mink Hollow. And those albums, he played a lot of the instruments himself, and that was fascinating to me. So I always kept in my head that sort of like Paul McCartney did on the McCartney album, or Stevie Wonder did on some of his records, this was a guy who could play every instrument himself and do his own backing vocals and everything and just create a wall of sound just with himself, you know. And that was interesting to me. And then I started to notice over the years that he produced the albums that I loved and worked with, like, and I'm a huge fan of XTC, and I remember reading stories about what a tortured relationship he had with the band while they were making that record. XTC and Todd Rundgren had huge head-to-head fights, verbal mainly, about how to make the album Skylarking, which to me was a great record. And so I thought, wow, pressure made diamonds in this case. One day I would like to tell that story, and then I realized there's other stories that were great. And then I met Todd Rundgren a few years ago, and I asked him a few key questions as a fan would, and I liked the way he answered the questions obliquely. So I always kept it in my head that whenever I get a chance to do a book where it's my choice what to write about, I'm going to try and pitch this to a publisher and see if they're interested. And this British publisher, Jawbone Press, it was just the perfect time for them. And they just said, oh, that'd be great. Could you get Todd? And I said, actually, I think I could. And actually, I could tell you that story too, because it's kind of an interesting, interesting sort of force of will that made this book happen.
Yeah, so he participated in the writing of this book. Does that color the view we have of him, though?
Well, it depends how you define participate. And I would say that whatever impression, like you read it and you came away with a feeling about him that I don't know if I led you down one garden path or not. I know that I tried to stay objective. Here's what his participation was. I said to his manager, I had this idea for a book that talks only about the arc of his production career, and sort of like one of those, you know, like those Faber and Faber film books where they talk about Scorsese or Coppola,
yeah,
and just talk about a music producer. And I went to the managers and I said, would Todd be interested in giving me a lot of interviews, because there's a lot of things to talk about, and if I do a bulk set of master interviews just with his opinion, then I'm going to go out, and I told them, I'm going to go out and get all the artists' opinions. So I'm going to talk to Cheap Trick, I'm going to talk to New York Dolls, I'm going to talk to Patti Smith, and then I'm going to match them up and see what the big story is. And, of course, my version of the distillation of those events is going to be still one version of the truth, but it's not all Todd's version. And what was awesome is that Todd Rundgren, I believe he's as good as his word. He says he doesn't care what people say about him, so he'll tell you what he thinks, and he'll know that you're going to write what you write. But he didn't tell me not to write something, and he didn't lie to me. He didn't tell me anything that I could tell was obviously untrue. Now, his memory would be different than some people, maybe. Like, if Meatloaf had a bad time in the studio and he didn't know it, I hear that from Meatloaf, he might not have told Todd that. So I don't, like, that's the kind of thing. So I have to say, I got a uniquely honest artist here, like, you know, and mainly because he professes to not care what I wrote about him.
As a musician, is writing a book like this and talking to all the people that you've talked to for it, is it instructive?
Instructive to whom?
To, like, the musician that you are?
Yeah, oh, God, yeah. It is so... To me, what I love about being a writer, as a musician being a writer, is that I get to sit there and ask the questions. I'm controlling what I learn from all these masters that I talk to. So I sit there and talk to Daryl Hall from Hall & Oates, who I think is an incredible singer with an incredible pedigree, and I'm on the phone with him, and I'm asking him, you know, instead of reading it in another person's article and waiting for the interviewer to ask that question, I get to ask the question. So I control the flow of what I need to know, and it's the payoff for the whole job for me, is to sit there and go, you know, in my last book I talked to Eric Clapton about Long John Baldry, who we talked about that last time I was on your show,
right?
And the whole thing about that was, like, I didn't wait to find out what Eric Clapton said somewhere. I managed to track him down and ask him myself, which, to me, that's, you know, you don't get paid a lot to write books, you know, but the thing you get is these great moments of interactions with history, you know.
You mentioned the Skylarking record earlier.
Yes.
And you got to find out about what was going on behind the scenes. When you listen to it again, does that change your opinion of it?
No, in fact, well, okay, change being, you know, again, the operative direction of that question is, does it change it for the better or worse? I think what it does is it humanizes it. And a lot of things like that happen in you know, and that's the upshot of the entire book for me is I look at the man now, flaws and all, and I look at his career and I go, wow, there's an impulsive guy there who pushes those mixes to make them sound a little rough, and there's a guy who, you know, frankly annoyed a lot of the people he worked with, but I still think, you know, he's an inspiring force of will and someone worthy of this kind of study. And so to answer your question about Skylarking, I'm a huge, huge fan of XTC, and I have a huge admiration for all the players and writers in that band. And knowing that Andy Partridge of XTC fought with Todd Rundgren about the birthing of that record, it only makes me think that, you know, they both cared so much, and the product was so much better than, I mean, I say better. It to me, it turned out, you know, much better than either man could have made on their own. And I think knowing the story even makes it feel that more special.
The Baldry book, you wrote that after Baldry died.
Yes.
In this case, the subject was still living. Is it easier to write a book about someone that's living? I would think it would be easier if they were dead, because you know the full story.
Well, that's true, too. You know, but it's six of one, half dozen of the other, because on the one hand, with Baldry, with Baldry, I did have a finite end to the story.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I had to draw on secondhand interviews, and I was also lucky, by the way, on that one, that Nick Orchard had been shooting a documentary about Baldry about 2 years before he died, and had these open-ended, unedited camera interviews with. So I had like literally the creepiest feeling sitting there with a DVD player watching Long John Baldry tell me, the audience, his life story. So some of the passages where I quote Baldry directly, were from this interview. So I had this living will, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a living will, you know, those video testimonies. And so that was interesting, having him tell me his story from beyond the grave. And, of course, the other thing about the Todd book is I get to have access to him, so I can email him if something in the transcript doesn't ring true. I'm like, hey, Todd, you said 1973, but that album wasn't made until 75. And he'll go, oh, yeah, maybe I got that wrong. So I couldn't do that with Baldry. And so my book, my Todd book ends with, you know, kind of a vague, you know, who knows what he'll do next. You know, but I also am lucky that he's 63 and things take a lot longer to happen for artists who are 63. So there's not as good a chance of my book being obsolete as it would have been if I'd written about, Justin Bieber, whose legend is yet to be made.
Right,
you know?
Yeah. The book doesn't focus on his personal life as much. This is all about him in the studio, right?
Yeah, I deliberately did that. Part of the reason is I don't like tabloids. I don't like TMZ. I don't like the entire tabloid culture. Far too many people have an opinion about people's personal lives now that they shouldn't have, in my opinion. And, I'm sure some people find that, you know, car crashes to be entertainment and stuff like that. So, that's a hyperbolic explanation of what I mean. But I also find that in my writing, I am fascinated by process. I am fascinated by art. I'm fascinated by the act of creation and the commerce that led to the creation and all the things attended to creation. So I'm not interested in the case of the Todd story, something that's like perhaps an elephant in the room for a TMZ person would be. He raised Liv Tyler, the actress, as his own daughter for several years, and there was some question for many years that he thought he was the father, according to some reports, and it was actually Steven Tyler had been having an affair with Todd's partner, the actress model Bebe Buell. And Bebe, I talked to her, and I didn't use a lot of it for the book, but I talked to her to get the background, the deep background stuff about, you know, what was going on here? Were you living in the house then? Had you guys broken up yet? But that wasn't what I wanted the book to be about. I just wanted to get a chronology so I could tell if Todd was living in upstate New York or had moved to Woodstock, or had moved to Hawaii. Like, I wanted to get all those stories straight. So for me, the personal details, you know, and you think about it. If I was Liv Tyler and I had to read yet again that her father was, you know, Steven Tyler, the junkie who couldn't raise his own kid, and, you know, like, it's not something you want to drag people through if you see them as human beings, which I'm hoping to do.
Yeah.
Is that enough of an answer?
Yeah. Well, what does Rundgren do now? You mentioned he's 63.
Yeah, he's, I gave him an extra year there. I think he's 63 in June next year.
So okay. Yeah.
He's actually 62, just to be honest. What he's doing now is he's because he's been an artist who hasn't pursued the commercial world as a main objective, he still has to work to make a living. So a lot of times he'll do, he has a blues project that's kind of a tribute to Robert Johnson that he tours with. He shows up at those Walk Down Abbey Road concerts, sometimes playing with Ringo Starr's All-Star Band. And last year he produced the New York Dolls' one of their comeback records, which was a reunion for him after 36 years, I think, so maybe 37 years. And he also is about to produce, believe it or not, he's going to produce a record for Donny and Marie Osmond, but only because their management is the same people who have been managing Todd Rundgren for years. So it's one of those things where they just thought, let's keep it in-house. But I don't think he went out of his way to find Donny and Marie. he also toured a couple of retro tours, performing his classic 70s album, A Wizard of True Star, in its entirety, and those are mainly attended by sort of this Grateful Dead-style core of fans that really, really want him to play all his old hits, you know.
How does he view his own music? I mean, as a producer, I would think that he's critical of it?
Well, you got to understand that he also doesn't put much faith in people's opinions, including his own, about what's good and what's not good. But what he will allow of himself is that he believes he is a passable guitar player, which is an understatement because he's a great guitar player. He has become a great singer, and he actually will admit that he worked on that. If you listen to his earlier records, he was nasal, and he didn't really have a lot of stamina. And he taught himself how to make better vocal production and how to sing. And now I saw him recently, and his voice has dropped an octave, as older voices do, but he is definitely a much better singer. He could play in a Broadway show now. And actually, that's something about his music. I discovered that there's this element of Broadway show tunes that goes through his music. He's very inspired by Gershwin, Sondheim, and as well as some classical composers and 20th century classical composers like Debussy and Ravel. And that's a side to him that I see him as he gets older. I see him perhaps doing more of, you know. But he's become a much better singer, and I think he sees himself as somebody who knows his way around an arrangement. Like he won't brag ever, but he'll say he knows he's very good at this. He feels that it's too easy to write sort of Carole King type pop songs for him, and what he means by that is he's mastered the sort of mathematical equation of it. But if he's inspired, he will write one, but he doesn't want to do it just because he knows how, you know. So that's an interesting thing I noticed about him.
You know, I was wondering about you. How do you listen to music? Do you listen to it on an iPod? Do you have a stereo at home?
I have a variety of systems, and it's been a kind of a thing lately as I'm transitioning based on scheduling and time. I do listen at my computer quite a lot with headphones plugged into my laptop, so high-quality producer headphones hooked up to my laptop. But I also find myself really loving long drives in my little Toyota Echo because music sounds great when you're going across the Bay Bridge here in San Francisco. There's something about having a great record on. And, so I like that a lot. And so those are the two things. I used to listen to my iPod more often, and then I just found it a hassle to keep recharging it. I have to say I've kind of weaned myself off my own iPod.
Yeah.
That was a Freudian slip because I just bought an iPad, and I'm toying around with the idea of using that as my principal airplane music, like storing the tunes on the iPad, and so that you can also watch, you know, films and stuff. I like the whole iPad idea.
Yeah. Do you think you could write on an iPad?
Write music?
Oh, write like a book, say?
You know what? I have not mastered the art of typing on the touchpad screen, like the way I can type on a keyboard. You know, I find like it's great for tweeting. You know, you can do the hunt and peck method. You know, where you move one finger around really quickly. That's cool, but I haven't been confident enough to sit there in my typing mode, you know. So I think that if I was to write on an iPad, I would probably, I don't even know if they make one, an external keyboard, like peripheral would be awesome.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's someone working on that, Griffin or something, you know, some third-party manufacturer.
Early in the book, you compared Rundgren to the Woody Allen movie Zelig and the character Zelig. What's your favorite Woody Allen movie?
Oh, that's an interesting offbeat question. Favorite Woody Allen movie, I've always said Manhattan, because whereas a lot of his films, earlier funnier films, as he would say, are wacky, and they're kind of, you know, extensions of his stand-up, and some of his later films are kind of morose New York Upper East Side drama, you know, like they're almost like little plays. I think Manhattan was a fully realized, you know, the cinematography of Gordon Willis and the acting, and there was just something really timeless about that film, Manhattan. And even though it's anachronistic now to look at the 70s New York, I felt like it was an honest piece of work. I think I can actually say Manhattan.
Someone mentioned, I think, I can't remember the guy's name now, he's a columnist at the Globe and Mail, said that was his favorite movie. The line in the movie where he's in the cab with Mariel Hemingway, and he says, "You're really beautiful, but you've made me take my eye off the cab meter."
I think that's the line.
That's
a great line.
Yeah. Anyway, what's next for you, Paul?
Well, I'm actually trying to put together. I've got a sort of. I've got some interest in this book about the Talking Heads. The Talking Heads were, as if you're not familiar, the band from the 70s and 80s and just into the 90s. David Byrne. And they made a perfect, in my mind, a perfect set of albums. Like, there's not one Talking Heads album that I can point to that is a weak album. There are better ones within the canon, but I just think a perfect career like that, in terms of artistic success anyway, I'd like to write a book much like this one where I talk about the stories that got them to the studio. So not about their personal life, not necessarily like this one, not a biography of their personal lives as much as how their personalities and their life as a band led to them making these records, and sort of a record-by-record look at their career. I'm fascinated with this whole idea. I really want to do a lot of in-the-studio books. So that's the next thing. And I have a band here in San Francisco called the Paul and John. I am the Paul. And we do original songs that I write with a guy named John Mormon.
Yeah. So. You know, I'm as you know, I'm not a fan of this music. But you're a pretty good writer, Paul. And I'm not just saying that because you're on. That it makes reading this book, and I'm sure, especially the Baldry book, I'm thinking of that, that it makes it compelling and worthwhile reading.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's good to talk to you again. You're one of my favorite Facebook friends. You're always there.
I'm right back at you. And of course, now I've gone crazy on Twitter. So, by the way, you mentioned earlier my blog. It's actually not Plum Ears. It's Pulmyers, like Pull My Ears with one L.
Pulmyers.
Yeah, think of pulling my ears, but without the second L.
Pull my ears. Pullmyears.wordpress.com. That's how we say it, I guess,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and it's an anagram for my name, Paul Myers.
So there you go. Paul, thanks again. Good luck with the book.
Thank you, Joseph.
You're very welcome. The book is called A Wizard, A True Star, Todd Rundgren in the Studio. Jawbone is its publisher, its author, Paul Myers, on the line from Berkeley, California. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.